It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We learn about climate migration, climate resilience, and why it is human to move in the face of climate impacts with Climate Alpha. They launched this climate software that uses sophisticated modeling and AI to help predict where it might make sense to invest in real estate and where it may not, with modeling covering all U.S. zip codes. Join in at the intersection of migration and climate. What risks you think about in your community? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Parag Khanna is a geostrategist and founder and CEO of Climate Alpha. His latest book is Move. Parag, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Well, good morning. Let's start with Hurricane Ian, which hits close to home in the U.S. Seminole County, Florida says Ian damaged or destroyed nearly 2,000 homes in the region. And then the NASA models say hurricanes will grow in intensity. Can people afford to keep rebuilding in the same place that has been hit hard by natural disasters?
Well, we know for a fact that those specific individuals can't, since most of them don't even have insurance. And so it's not only the immediate damage that the hurricane did, but the uninsured percentage of the population. So, and obviously with future disasters to come and even increase in intensity, the question really is, should they even want to rebuild in the same place, even if they could afford to? And that becomes a public policy issue, because obviously we're partially underwriting that through taxpayer money, through reconstruction grants and so forth. I fall in the camp of people who believe that we should kind of let the climate models lead our migrations and movements, and we should encourage and incentivize and support Americans to relocate to places that are more climate resilient.
I want to pick up there on what you said, because I saw this living in Louisiana for 15 years. Homes get hit over and over and over with flooding and extreme storms and storm surge. So what you see is repetitive losses, and then insurance just is through the roof. It almost becomes like a luxury good that also divides class and race. Can you explain that, or what is unfolding in real estate as it intersects with climate?
Well, there's no question that things like insurance pricing, whether it's flood, fire, or other categories, and then the long-term uninsurability of locations is raising that cost. And given that, you know, insurance is often required, even though it's overlooked, you're looking at just continuously adding to the price of owning a home in locations where those assets are going to depreciate over time, because people are going to be moving away. And that's exactly what's happened in much of Louisiana as a whole, as in certainly key cities in Louisiana. And then again, there's the public policy side as taxpayers. The Straight Grid of Louisiana, Entergy, right, takes, you know, anywhere from $700 million to $1 billion a year to rebuild power lines. But those power lines are not designed to withstand Category 4, Category 5 storms. So they just get destroyed again. So that's just not a good use of our taxpayer money, right? And it's quite frankly, I'm not being insensitive. This is really about the American dream. I'm actually thinking about those individuals. And I'm saying, do we Americans want to be a survival society? And whether you're a wealthy person whose home was destroyed in Colorado in a fire, or whether you're a poor person whose home's been destroyed in the Gulf Coast, the fact that, you know, if you want Americans to continue to actually even be able to attain the American dream, which is an appreciating home over time, that home is going to need to be in a more climate resilient place. So it's something that is genuinely utilitarian. It's in the best interest of Americans that we steer the markets and individuals to think about relocating to more stable areas.
But no community is perfectly stable, right? No community is immune to the effects of climate change or, you know, a 100-year flood. So where will climate migrants go?
It's very true. Maybe not even Wisconsin is totally immune, but it's about the relative performance of locations. You know, look, when I started writing this book, I thought it would be a linear story. Like, people will move from area X to area Y. Mm-hmm. I actually came to a very different conclusion at the end of all of my research, which is that we are, you know, in all likelihood, people will move multiple times, because you never really know what disruption may occur in a certain place. It could be climate, but it could also be just overpopulation and the higher cost of living, right? If a place becomes over gentrified, this is what just happened in like Boise, right? Everyone decided they wanted to leave California and go to Idaho. And now you can't even, you know, the people who lived in Boise, who live in Boise, can barely afford trailers, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, where you haven't built sufficient supply and you haven't thought about the housing market and the economy in terms of the capacity to absorb more people, people who actually were in a climate resilient place like Boise actually have to leave Boise. And that's just one anecdote to prove the point, which is that, you know, I don't have a firm conclusion that everyone should move to Wisconsin, you know, or to the Great Lakes region. I have obviously identified, and I'm far from the only one, to identify this as a more resilient geography than the Gulf Coast. That no longer takes a rocket scientist or a climate scientist in this case to
figure
out.
Well, I'm glad
you
say it and not me, but
but that doesn't mean that we're doing everything we need to do to prepare for these regions that are more resilient to absorb greater populations. And now I applaud the municipal leadership from, you know, Buffalo to Wisconsin, you know, in Minnesota and Michigan saying, hey, you know, we are more climate resilient. Our economies have suffered from an outflow of people. We'd like to welcome people back, and we need to, you know, gain the investment, public and private, and from citizens and homeowners to come back and make these economies stronger. Right now, again, ironically, Michigan still loses people because people aren't leaving because it's not climate resilient. They're leaving because there are not enough jobs and activity. So you have to look at those places like Detroit, you know, where you're starting to see a genuine rebound. I get a great vibe when I go there, you know, to Detroit and other great cities in the Great Lakes region that that need to kind of plan ahead, brand themselves, attract that investment. Look at, you know, semiconductors now was just announced. Upstate New York is gaining a big semiconductor plant. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen so attracting investment is what attracts people, what creates jobs and has that positive self-fulfilling kind of prophecy. And, you know, America is a huge country full of lots of climate resilient areas. I have to remind people of this all the time, you know, with our own company, where there's just this sky is falling kind of mentality. And yes, it's true that climate change is occurring at a much faster rate and, you know, in a much more devastating way than we could imagine. And there's, we should have lots of regrets about allowing it to get this bad. But that said, maybe, you know, at the very least, what we should remind ourselves is as much as we need to slow that down, we are a huge country. We have plenty of climate resilient places. There's plenty of locations for 350 or even 400 million people to live if we plan ahead and do this right. And that's where we need to devote our efforts.
Well, Parag Khanna, what about the Midwest in particular? We've heard about Milwaukee and Minneapolis, Columbus, among top cities to live in when factoring in climate change. What does the Midwest have when you look at your data?
Well, the answer is actually yes. And, you know, you're obviously correct about those cities and very qualified people, including our own models, you know, have pointed out that these locations should appreciate more over time, given their readiness, their, well, both their lower climate risk and their and the increasing infrastructure investment that is promoting the overall readiness to withstand, you know, climate risk in those locations, right? Mm-hmm. So those are, when I gave my answer, I said yes, and because it's not just about the cities that are on the map today that are prominent today. You know, history is all about the movement of people from one place to another over time, either gradually or suddenly. And there are smaller places on the map that aren't in that list of top 10 this and top 10 that. You know, a lot of Americans during COVID moved to smaller towns, towns that you and I have never heard of, right? In states that we haven't traveled to lately. And that's also part of the story. So the answer isn't just, you know, move to Columbus, move to Minneapolis, you know, or you know, Duluth, whatever the case may be. You know, the answer is think about the economy, the social characteristics, and the climate of many different options that are available all across the Midwest region.
Parag Khanna with us leads a tech platform, Climate Alpha. They're looking at machine learning to assess real estate with climate change modeling, predicting how property values will change in decades to come. Join in on human migration risk, what climate resiliency means for your living situation, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore how people will migrate due to climate change and these other forces and what it means for Wisconsin and the Midwest. A White House climate report from last year says tens of millions of people are likely to be displaced over the next two or three decades due in large measure to climate change. Join in on migration, what you anticipate. Would you leave home? 800-642-1234. Geostrategist Parag Khanna founded the software tech platform Climate Alpha and stays with us on these migration trends. Let's bring in Greg in Sheboygan. Greg, hi. What would you like to bring up?
I believe that cities are not designed at all. I mean, we need to build an enclosed city of, say, 5 million people, totally enclosed, using geothermal heat. We could mine right next to it straight down and take all the elements out that we can use, all the metals, and we can use a lot of the non-metals also in pure state. And we can, I ran pilot plants in chemistry, and we can separate anything, basically. And what we need to do is we need to have cities in closed spaces and not these single houses generating so much CO2 and so much methane gas that leaks out of your stove when you cook. We're going to go extinct otherwise. I've seen 95% of the things that were alive when I was a kid dead now. They're gone. All the sphinx moths, I'm looking right now at 30-some species, the sphinx moths that are in my cases that are just gone.
Greg, I want to pause. Let's pause right there. And just for some placemaking here, Parag, Greg calling from Sheboygan, which has the nickname Malibu of the Midwest because it's on the shores of Lake Michigan. Parag, go ahead. Your reflections.
Well, maybe I need to move there if the nickname is Malibu of the Midwest, because I'm guessing its climate profile is better than Malibu, California, right? Or Hawaii.
I think I just derailed that. So, I think I derailed that. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, so I mean, I think the crux of it is this idea of, you know, enclosing a city and drilling into the ground and the self-sufficiency. And I think this is something I want to really explain in a bit more detail. Yes, in theory, a certain location may have the capacity for energy self-sufficiency based upon natural resources, geothermal, hydropower, solar, whatever the case may be. But you don't want to stretch that argument too far, because again, there could be tornadoes that devastate a place. There could be, again, economic disruptions to supply chains, to importing, you know, food. So the idea, and he's not saying this, but it's really tempting me in this day and age where we talk about nearshoring and self-sufficiency and, you know, cutting off our dependencies internationally to China and so forth. Let's be really careful that no place is this idyllic, perfect island that can really survive on its own, because if anything happens to it, and you've cut off your ties to your neighbors and those beyond, you're going to be stuck. Mm-hmm. So it's all about having some moderation between, definitely in the energy space, of course I agree. You know, why should we be putting oil on tankers and sending around the world to power homes when we can use local, you know, fuel? But should anything happen to your local energy supply or material supply, you do want to be connected to a grid of some kind and be able to draw upon other sources.
Let's go to Madeline now in De Pere. Madeline, what would you like to bring up?
Yes, I did. I want to agree with that man that said, you know, that we can't keep spending billions of dollars to rebuild places like Florida and that little island over there. You know, we should be spending the money to help those people relocate. We know that those hurricanes are going to keep coming. They're going to keep getting worse. And so how many times are we going to pay to rebuild? And we should help those people to relocate. But also, I'd like to introduce birth control. I don't think...
Okay. Well,
no,
Madeline, all right, I want to just, you know, not divert there, but, you know, something that Prague, I'm sure you've explored, home is your home. Home is your livelihood. Home is your roots. And to actually, you know, have such a shift in your life, to have to move away from all of that suddenly or unexpectedly and then plant that those roots elsewhere, that's a tall order. That's a big ask.
Well, the only thing that's deeper than that sense of home is our instinct for survival, right? Fight or flight, mm-hmm. right? I would argue, right, against anyone that you would ultimately prefer to survive than die in place, at least for 90% of people, right? So I'm appealing to that. Again, it's human, literally human nature, that fight or flight. It's actually mammalian nature, not just human nature, to ultimately want to survive and be in a safe place. And if it means that you're one of the unfortunate people who is in a place that's no longer livable, then your home is no longer there, right? But again, be grateful. It's a huge country that we have, America, right? And mm-hmm. there's many places you can be that are not that far away. You started with the question of Hurricane Ian. Let's bear in mind that 20 kilometers inland from Fort Myers were places that were relatively untouched, right? So we're not talking about picking up and moving to another country, which is what most refugees actually do have to do, right? So we don't really, again, in the grand scheme of things, as regrettable as it is that we are in this situation, right? So I'm not being flippant, but you don't necessarily in America have to move very far from where you are to be in a resilient place. And again, we should be extremely grateful for that fact.
Prague Khanna, Climate Alpha CEO and author, you can join in on climate migration, 800-642-1234. Let's turn for a moment to Climate Alpha in using machine learning to determine where property investors should find the most value for their dollars in these unpredictable times of climate impacts. Where are the top regions to invest in the world?
Well, globally, actually, this is kind of the subject of the book as well as what we do as a platform. You know, to answer that question, you have to have not only climate models, because, you know, climate models may tell you that parts of Russia are going to be very livable in the 21st century. I don't see a lot of people moving to Russia right now, right?
No.
So it's a lot more than just climate. What we've done is to take all the climate data, but also the property market data, the transaction history, the valuation data, and then the socioeconomic and demographics. Like, you know, where is life expectancy strong? Where is their economic growth? Where are people moving to because of either COVID and remote work or climate change, or because of investment coming in, job creation, technology, quality of life, low crime? We take hundreds of those data sets and we actually engineer them together to get a holistic picture of what's a good place. And a good place is not just a place where it's either sunny or where, you know, you're not at risk of sea level rise. It takes a lot more for a place to be a desirable place. So we're looking for all of those characteristics simultaneously. And again, America has lots of them. Canada has lots of them. All over the world, they're there. And it could be a place where the climate models tell you, oh, it's going to be scorching. Like take a place like Dubai, right, mm-hmm. in the Middle
yes.
East. Now, of course, no one says that I want to, you know, have 140 degree, you know, or 120, 130 degree temperature every day.
No.
Of course not. But they have air conditioning everywhere. And relative to other places near it that are racked by civil war and also very hot with no air conditioning, it's a better place to be. And most people can't move very far. So we're measuring things like the proximity of people to resilient places, the cost of living in those places, the climate resilience of those places. And we don't come with the best answer in like a static way, like this is the best place. It's what's the best place for you based upon where you are and the proximity to livable places and the cost and affordability of those places. So the answer is many, many answers, actually.
Prague, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Prague Khanna is a futurist at the intersection of climate migration and real estate, founder and CEO of Climate Alpha. Up ahead, we continue the conversation on climate. We learn how climate change could affect mosquito population and mosquito-borne diseases, other pests. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. As our planet warms and climate change extends the mosquito season, we find out what that means for Wisconsin and the Midwest with mosquito-borne illnesses. The World Mosquito Program cites hundreds of millions of people being infected each year. Join in on the mosquito population, what you've seen with breeding, what you experienced in recent months, 800-642-1234. Dan Bimont is here, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. Dan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
And Lyric Bartholomew is here as well, professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at UW-Madison, co-director of the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Diseases. Lyric, welcome to you.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Kate.
So, Lyric, hi, let's start with you. Your research showing this invasive Asian tiger mosquito more likely to survive in our winters in tires. What are you finding out?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So back in 2016, when Zika hit the United States, we started looking for the Asian tiger mosquito called Aedes albopictus here in Wisconsin. And in 2017, we found them in a few different tire yards in southern Wisconsin counties. And so we decided to do some work to try and understand whether those mosquitoes would really be able to undergo all of the pressures of surviving a cold Wisconsin winter. So we set up some really cool experiments where we set out tires. Well, I think they're cool. We set out tires with eggs in them from this particular mosquito species and let them sit over the winter, brought them back to the lab and hatched them. And what we found was that the tires alone provide some nice insulation for the mosquito eggs. But if the mosquito eggs are to survive cold winters, it really takes being covered in snow. So they need like this extra blanket of snow to keep warm enough to survive what we currently are experiencing as Wisconsin winters. So maybe it was a little bit counterintuitive. And we did this work during the polar vortex. So it got really, really cold. And you can totally understand why a little mosquito egg out in the environment would need an extra blanket to survive.
Absolutely. I thought it was so interesting that you used tires, because aren't tires part of the origin story of how the Asian tiger mosquito got here in the first place?
Yeah, that's exactly right. What we find is that tires move globally in ships, and they are transported all over for sale and also for recycling. And it turns out that they're just the perfect conduit for bringing in mosquito eggs and new invasive mosquito species.
So Dan, the study says warming global temperatures means that the disease-carrying mosquitoes could cover all of Wisconsin by 2065. Can you describe what could average winters be like in 2065?
Yeah, we've done some work with the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, and the publication itself also includes some of that, where we've projected forward the expected changes in temperature over the next 50 and 100 years. And we expect warming of somewhere around 3 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit over the next 50 years in the wintertime. And one thing we see is that the wintertime, the really extreme cold temperatures become less frequent. So we get about half as many days with here in Wisconsin where the temperature gets below zero Fahrenheit. So we do expect that warming to continue. And if we think about that as a kind of a north-south variation, overall warming means a northward push of that kind of threshold for those mosquitoes, I think.
Mosquitoes, and I would imagine other insects carrying disease-borne illnesses. I would think that the warming temperatures would help be more of a gateway to our area.
It is. I think it is true. I'll let Lyric chime in on this one. But yeah, there is as temperatures warm, that makes winters more amenable towards overwintering of a lot of these species.
Lyric, I've read that the Asian tiger mosquito is really an aggressive biter that feeds primarily during the day, and that's not good news for us. What can you tell us about the tendencies of this mosquito?
Yeah, it is a really nasty biter, Kate. So I have some in my lab, and I know when they are biting me because it really hurts. it's painful. And as you said, they bite during the day, and they really can lay their eggs and grow in all kinds of containers and places and spaces in people's yards. So you could imagine that there'd be a lot of these mosquitoes being produced, and that it would be really burdensome to people who really like to recreate outdoors, as we know Wisconsinites do. So people who like to be in their backyards gardening and things like that are really, really bothered by this species. So we'd like to keep it away for as long as we can.
What about other hosts, like biting pets?
Yeah, this one actually really tends to bite most on people, which is really interesting. It's one of those human biters that likes to be in and around people's houses. So it's really problematic.
We're looking at the effects of climate change on pests like mosquitoes, and we have Lyric Bartholomew and Dan Vimond from UW-Madison. Dan, professor, studies atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Lyric with us, professor, studying infectious disease agents in mosquitoes and ticks, other parasites. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Dan, you know, mosquitoes and ticks are both cold-blooded, and you know, Lyric's research suggests snowpack helps them survive winters, especially like really, really cold one temperatures. And so what will you expect average snowfall to be like in coming decades?
Good question. With more warming, I suppose. One thing that we find is that the duration of the snow season decreases, and that also translates to reduced snow on the ground. So that might be a tempering effect of this. However, that occurs because it's getting warmer. And so we also see that these really cold episodes are likely to not happen as often. Although lately we've seen these big polar vortex events and these very extreme cold events. And so that's kind of where we're at in terms of how we understand variations in wintertime. We're currently trying to understand whether or not those variations, those polar vortex events, will become more frequent, or whether the overall warming will be the dominant impact there. So I think, you know, this study, one thing I really am excited about with this is that it introduces kind of this give and take, this interplay between me as a climate scientist and the studying of these mosquitoes, that it introduces new problems and introduces new ideas that we really need to study, because obviously it's very important.
And what about rainfall in coming decades? I mean, we see these low pressure systems stalling out, dumping, you know, extreme rain events on our regions. So what do you see there in coming decades?
One thing we see with rainfall is we expect an increase in rainfall during the winter, and especially the spring, fall, winter, and spring. And that could lead to more snow if the temperature stays below zero. But one thing that we've certainly seen in Madison over the last, or in southern Wisconsin recently, is that those rain events are occurring on a warming climate as well. And so these rain on snow events, if you get rain when there's snow there, it's really effective at just getting rid of that snow. And so it's not clear exactly how snow, rain, and temperature all interact to contribute to changes in habitat.
Yes, Lyric, rainfall and the mosquito population. I mean, we all know about trying to, in the summer, to eliminate that standing water. What does your research tell you?
Yeah, that's right. We really promote this idea of tip and toss in people's yards to encourage people after a rain to get rid of that standing water. I think this year was a really interesting year for climate and weather in Wisconsin, and we saw a really cold, long spring, maybe some extended dry conditions, and just really small burden of mosquitoes. And a lot of people have told us, Yeah, there just don't seem to be any mosquitoes this year. And a lot of that does relate to cold temperatures and the availability of standing water, which is dependent on rain. So all of those things factor in when we think about how many mosquitoes are going to be out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You need that just the right mix.
That's great.
You know,
yeah, and too much water is bad for mosquitoes, actually. So We see that if there's drenching rain that sort of overflows the containers that the mosquito larvae are in, that's a loss for the population. A gain for us, maybe, but a loss for them.
We heard from Harold in Stillwater, Minnesota, called and couldn't stay on the line. But Harold says mosquitoes have been around for millions of years, Lyric, and for us to be all up in arms now is a distraction. And Randy says the benefits of a mosquito outweigh any annoyance people might have. What are your thoughts there?
Wow, I think I'd like to be friends with you. So I actually totally agree that we should better understand what it is that mosquitoes are contributing to ecosystems, and that there certainly is benefit to their presence. I mean, they annoy us and they transmit disease, and we need to be able to control them, and we need to work with people like Dan to predict where they're going to be and when. But there's a balance, and I think we have to live with them and understand that they're feeding birds and feeding frogs and pollinating plants in some cases even.
We are getting an update on the mosquito population as summers get longer, winters get warmer. UW-Madison scientist Lyric Bartholomew here. Dan Vimont as well. Join in on the effects of floods, rainfall, droughts, longer summers, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Health Department last week confirmed the first human case this year of West Nile virus. Despite cooler temps, mosquito bite prevention still necessary in fall. Your questions on climate change and the intersections, mosquitoes, 800-642-1234. UW-Madison's Lyric Bartholomew is here, and Dan Vimont, stay with us. Lyric, co-director of the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Diseases. Dan, a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Let's go to Randy in Preston, Minnesota. Randy, what's on your mind?
Well, the last person who called in a comment about kind of freaking out about the diseases of mosquitoes and everything. I just think that's going to end up not being much of an issue as every step forward we take to address climate gets two steps back by President Joe Manchin. And as we run out of drinkable fresh water and everything that can burn.
Randy, you're breaking up a bit, and this really intersects with both of you, Dan and Lyric. Dan, you first on, we have to keep our eye here on climate change itself.
Yeah, this is certainly true. I think there's a couple of points there. One is that we do need to be stopping the amount of climate change that we'll likely experience. But the other part of that is that there is a long time scale built into the climate system. So what we do now has an enormous effect by the end of the century in terms of changing how much warming we'll expect. And it's critical that we do something, that we start taking action now. By mid-century, we're already locked in to a certain amount of climate change. And so we can already start planning for those changes. One thing we can do is we can start, and this is something that's going on with the Department of Health Service as well here at Wisconsin, we can start planning for changes in vector-borne illnesses, and we can start being prepared for these sorts of things. And that's going to happen across all kinds of different, not just vector-borne illnesses, but also changes in forestry, changes in wildlife, changes to heat impacts, ice cover, all sorts of stuff. We can start preparing for that right now. And this is a great example. This study is a great example of a way that we can start thinking about being prepared for what's coming and helping out citizens here in Wisconsin as well.
Lyric, your thoughts on Randy saying, look, mosquito-borne diseases pale in comparison to really working on global warming writ large.
Yeah, I would echo that idea and also what Dana said and recognize that the work that we do is really important in this idea of what we call One Health and thinking about how animals, including insects and people and the planet, all interact, and the impacts will be many. And so, my role is to work in the realm of vector-borne diseases, and I do think there are going to be changes to what we understand in terms of the threat of mosquito and tick-borne diseases as time goes on. And I know those things are really important to Wisconsinites.
And I think
Minnesota as well.
I think you really run a fine line between eliminating, like, the Asian tiger mosquito versus control of a mosquito population, and how, because it affects the rest of the ecosystem. So how do you walk that line?
Yeah, one thing I would take a moment to recognize with all of our listeners is that there are 54 different kinds of mosquito in Wisconsin, and this Asian tiger mosquito is one of the invaders. And so I can reconcile fighting the invasive species that aren't meant to be here and protecting public health and making it comfortable for people to be outdoors. But there are all these other species that are here, and their habitats will be changing really radically. So we work with mosquitoes, for example, that are up in northern Wisconsin that are larvae in frozen pools. So like out in the beautiful woods in northern Wisconsin, if you find these temporal pools that last for just a little while as the snow melts, these mosquitoes emerge. They emerge at the same time. There's a whole bunch of spring ephemeral flowers in the forest, and their timing is probably really interconnected and really important. And so mosquitoes may be providing some services in terms of pollination for those flowers. And so as we think about a changing climate, some of the mosquitoes that we know in Wisconsin will probably actually go away because the conditions just won't be right for them anymore.
Hmm. That's interesting. This might be an appropriate, modest segue, if you will, to Steve in Lake Geneva, wondering what to do if you have a pond.
Yes. Hi there.
Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, so I was just curious what pond owners, owners of both natural and man-made ponds, can do to minimize ponds from becoming a large source of mosquito habitat, particularly for the invasive species. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Steve. Lyric.
Oh, thank you so much for the question, Steve. I think one of the things we find is that a really healthy pond that has a lot of fishes and mosquito larval predators in it is probably going to take reasonably good control of the mosquitoes that are there. So one of my colleagues, Susan Paskowitz, did some work to show that fathead minnows, for example, do a pretty good job of cleaning out mosquitoes. There's some other kinds of fish, gambusia and other kinds of fish that you could actually put in a pond, and they really love to eat mosquito larvae. So you could do mosquito control that way. And also at your local gardening store, you can find these little briquettes called mosquito dunks. They release BT toxin, the same thing that's in genetically modified corn, for example. Hmm. Those dunks do a great job of also controlling mosquito larvae in ponds.
Dan, I want to ask you, as former head of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, how is our state's response to climate change comparing to other states at this point?
That's a good question. I think one of the things that we've done very well is we've set up this this ability to interact between different agencies, between the university and state agencies, as well as just people across the state. And so that's I'm talking about the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, and that became sort of a model for doing this kind of work, certainly in the Midwest, but also across the U.S. People have kind of recognized Wisconsin as a model for bringing people together to address impacts of climate change. And you know, this discussion that we're having is a great example of why we need to bring people together to think about these kinds of issues. You know, as a climate scientist, half these questions that are being asked, I have no idea how to answer them. But when I get to interact with someone like Lyric, then we have a conversation and new ideas come up, and we start recognizing, oh, here are ways that solutions can kind of emerge. And I think Wisconsin is especially well situated for that. We have a long ways to go, I think in that respect, we're doing very well.
You really can't work on climate impacts in a bubble. You have to think more broadly and work across disciplines.
Well, exactly. I think that's what makes it, you know, there's an opportunity here to bring us together. And I think, climate change, instead of being a divisive thing, should be something that brings us together as a community.
Well, Lyric and Dan, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks. Thank you for having us.
Dan Vimont, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. Lyric Bartholomew, professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at UW-Madison, co-director of the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Diseases. And earlier, we discussed climate migration with geostrategist Parag Khanna. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.